Series. This is the third one. I've been trying to contact her about the remaining ones the last month. But we'll discuss that. We'll discuss that afterwards. And so Kane, I was trying to think. And here, this is my home in New York, Yogamaya. So I speak here regularly. And the subjects are very unique because I can lecture every day without preparing when I teach all the sacred texts of India. And you know, I can just go one. I do it in the Bhakti Center every morning. I just sit down and. But this, it's kind of, you know, trying to make this teaching a little bit more accessible. And sometimes it takes deep thought. So I prepare the lectures. You know, different lectures. It takes a lot of time sometimes. But once I do it once, I never have to prepare. So what I was thinking of is that, especially in Yogamaya, a lot of people are just becoming interested in spiritual life and interested sometimes what is Christian thing. So I thought this would be interesting topic to discuss. You know, something that I've been thinking about for a while. I'll tell you what I'm going to do in a little while. But to show you that why I'm doing something like this, anybody see this magazine? Yeah, on the cover it said Sects, S-E-C-T-S, Sects. And the rebranding of Hare Krishna. And in it, there's a little Yogamaya section. Don't look now, the return of a cult classic. Don't look now, but the Hare Krishnas have left the airport and entered the boardroom. The much maligned Hindu sect has shed its freak show status and behind its yuppie friendly pillows of yoga, meditation, and clean living is transforming America into a postmodern ashram. Robes not required. So, and here's one of the sections. right? What I'm showing you is kind of relevant to kind of, this is a relevant subject. And 10 years ago, I would never think I could speak on something like this. And what I'm speaking on, I'm not going to speak dogma. I never do speak dogma. But I'm going to speak philosophy, reasonability of certain concepts. I hope it'll be interesting. I've been racking my brains trying to figure it out. Behind the ornately carved dark cherry doors of Yogamaya in New York's Chelsea neighborhood, shiny, happy, sinewy men adorned with headscarves, manicured scrub, and frayed top rope necklaces bend and breathe to the sound of a harmonium and hand cymbals ringing from a room down the hall. In it, a swami is leading a discussion entitled, "Can God Be Blue? The Study of Krishna." So many people just stumble into Hare Krishna, and it's always through the yoga class, says studio director Bryn Christman. Glenn Reese, who opened Yogamaya after burning out on Wall Street in his 40s, says that even if most of his students aren't proclaiming themselves Hare Krishna, they're definitely tuning into its spiritual wavelength. You see people discovering this ocean of new ideas, Reese says, and then it's up to them to explore it further or not. So that's really what this class is. It's the ocean of new ideas. You know, and people are just interested in hearing different new ideas. So, Bryn, I think, you know, this idea you had of the satsang here, it's been successful.
it's actually already happened. Well, I got in the hall somewhere.
A little poetic license.
Yeah.
Okay, so now the subject of the class. What do you think the class is about? Someone told me they wanted to know if God can be depressed. Can God be? It's not about that. What do you think the class is about? Okay, I'll tell you what I'm thinking, okay? I really want to discuss, you know, in the class itself, I think, which is really kind of interesting, we're sharing ideas to broaden people's perspectives, really. And see, my strategy here in this class is I want to discuss, you know, can God be blue? I can tell you the answer right now. Can God be blue? Yeah, God can be whatever he wants. There's no reason for it. I'm going to get this away so I can talk what I want to talk about. There's no reason. If there's a reason that God is something, then it's not God. Because it means that there's something higher than God. He's, you know, there's some order. So God is the way God wants to be. It's just actually kind of discovering that nature. God, can God be blue? If there's a reason, he is blue because then the law that makes him that is actually God and not that thing. So that's not going to be what the class is about. Sense. It's what I'm going to talk about is I want to talk about the reasonability of this kind of conception and of here, of divinity that you're seeing here in Yogamaya. And I want to discuss the reasonability of the existence of God. Then I want to talk about the reasonability of God being a person. Then I want to discuss, I'm not proving anything, the reasonability of God manifesting as Krishna, and the reasonability of the stories and life that's explained of Krishna as a reasonable conception of ultimate fulfillment or ultimate attainment. So that's really what I want to discuss. And you know, you don't have a particular... I'll ask a question right now. What is your faith? what do you actually believe is the ultimate basis of reality? And even if you're, you see, the other thing is, quite a few people here I know have the faith that Krishna is this, maybe some don't. But I think the class will be, okay, you're taping it, right? Okay. The class will be, I think, interesting to both. Even myself, you know, who's been in this set for so many years, this was so helpful to me. It really was. But what reason or understanding does, it opens you up to experience and knowledge. But one's conceptions ultimately of reality are going to have to be based on an experience, not just an understanding. So I think it's very, very helpful for everyone to explore what direction they will explore. Otherwise, you can never find out. To have knowledge, you must take risks. William James, I think he wrote the book, Varieties of Religious Experience. I get confused sometimes with Henry James and Jesse James. But I believe it's William James. What he said is, he said, if a person wants to find out whether a girl loves him, or it's the opposite way around, whatever it is, partner, you want to find out. I think it's politically correct. You don't know what language to use anymore. I can't believe it. This is the most serious subject I've ever taught, and it's already becoming a comedy. So let me. He used the example, but that was like years ago. He said that if you want to know whether a girl loves you, you first have to have the faith she does. Otherwise, you'll never find out. So there's a certain relationship with the kind of faith that based on reason and actually having that experience. But what is your conception of life? And then if I ask you what your conception of life is, then... what is your evidence for it? How did you come about that conclusion? Parananda?
I simply have faith in the followers of Krishna. I have no realization of Krishna myself.
Okay. So you're a fanatic. I won't embarrass anybody else already. Okay. Why did it move in this direction? So, what is the evidence? And so why do you believe? And most conceptions are not proofs. You weigh the evidence. You weigh the evidence. Yeah, there's something here. It said, which account of the world has the most explanatory power to make sense of what we see in the world and in ourselves? Really, that's what you're trying to find out. Basically speaking, there's very few things that are really subtle and sublime that you can actually prove. And sometimes when you get into theological type, it's Friday night, I can tell you what I've been doing for the last week. I've been reading these two books. And they're very, very heavy books. One is called Reasonable Faith by this rhetorician called William Lane Craig. The guy's as brilliant as, it's very detailed and technical. And another is called Reasons for God by Timothy Keller, who's an evangelical Christian in the city, but very intellectual. People go to him. I'm just trying to figure this out. But So basically, there's something called strong rationalism, a verification principle, that no one should believe anything if it's not verified by your direct senses or your logic. But it's not a principle that even the people who say that hold to themselves. It's not a principle the way people actually come to conclusions. They weigh evidence. It's like kind of like trying to decide something. You put on the glasses first and see if it works. So, and especially something like the absolute basis of reality, the absolute basis of existence. It's not something inert that you put under a microscope. Even if you want to understand another person, you can't do it by analysis. You can't understand another person by analysis. You can, you shouldn't do this, capture someone off the street and throw them in a dungeon, but you can never know them. It's something within personhood and being that has to be revealed, and trust and relationship. So you'll never get that kind of a dominance of your logic and your sense perception to understand things that are deep and sublime. It's really sufficient reasons that explains it better than other things. So that's what I'm really going to try to do today. And even that, you know, we are so defective. Our attitudes affect our perceptions. Just like if you see a person, if you're envious, you can't see them. It's not just even about the senses. It's how your senses... Hey, you're getting such a wonderful crowd of... There's so many wonderful programs going on in New York that I don't think people that get connected with the Hare Krishnas sleep anymore. It's just unbelievable. Thursday, Friday, Wednesday, Sunday, Sunday morning, Sunday evening. Okay, so what you're really trying to do is see the evidence, what accounts better for what you're seeing and understanding, really. And really, that's what we're going to try to do today. I wanted to put that out before I discuss the... you know, I just say in my own, I ask you what you believe, in my own convictions and, you know, it was an experience, but the reasonability of moving in that direction, which is what opened me up to that experience. The reasonability of it opened me up to that experience. And when you have that experience also, it's not that you can... tell someone what it is and have them, they have to have that experience. It's almost like there's, you know, you see with your eyes, there's another sense. There's another sense called faith. It's a mechanism of the mind which opens one up to experience. And it's something that develops with trust, and then one has that experience. But I want to show really, and I really think it's very, very strong. Let's analyze the evidence. Now, basically, I think the premise, I'm going to start with reasonability of God. I think this is pretty cutting edge in the yoga world here, pretty philosophical. Basically, there's two explanations which are logical. You have to have one or the other. On what is the evidence of the basis of this world, the basis of what you see. And you actually have two choices. There's only two choices, and they're contradictory. One choice is that there's purpose behind it, And another choice is that it's accidental. That's the only two choice. If it's accidental, then there's no purpose behind it. And if it has purpose, there's no accident behind it. So these are the only. And if you say purpose, a very interesting thing happens. If you say in the world you see purpose, you see reason, you see morality. If you see that, a very interesting thing happens. Purpose comes from consciousness. It comes from conscious being. It comes from person. So if you believe that there's reason and purpose in the world, then the ultimate reality in which everything is born from is personal. It has some consciousness and intention and will and thought. There's no other explanation. Once you have purpose, your purpose doesn't come from molecules moving around haphazardly. Reason doesn't come from that. Morality doesn't come from that. So I just want to give the some basic, I'm inspired to stand up and do my Jimmy Swagger type in the front here. And I'll sit down. I realize it's Friday night. And Friday night, in Indian science is so different. You know, they divide up the world, the day, into 36. They don't have hours, they have muhurtas. 36, 48 minutes. And different muhurtas are better for different things. The most auspicious muhurta for meditation is Brahma muhurta, 48 minutes before sunrise. So this muhurta is probably the muhurta for partying. It's probably not the philosophical muhurta, so I have to mix the philosophy with my frustration in never having become a stand-up comedian. I'm doing good today. Okay? But, okay. Just, it's really amazing, you know. So, is there purpose or reason or... So I'll just tell you one story is in the Hare Krishna movement, initially there were many people in Russia, but it was illegal. And they were tortured for their beliefs. The most moving book I've ever read that brought me to tears on every page was called Salted Bread. And it was about these Krishna devotees that were tortured for their beliefs. It was salted bread because, you know, they were in prison, they had to remain vegetarians. All they could eat was bread. And they wanted to make their mala for chanting their rosary type beads, and they would just take the bread and they would let it kind of harden or something, and they would make things. The story, the ending just brings you to tears, what happens at the end. But when they came out of when, you know, they Russia became free and they finally came to the holy land of Vrindavan, where we are. I remember they came to Calcutta. This is just an interesting story. It goes a little bit off, but it gets back. They came to Calcutta and we greeted them with kirtan, and then we gave them a feast, and then there was a papaya. And my friend in the monk robes was sitting next to one of the people that were in jail. I mean, people, pregnant ladies were in jail and they lost their children. People were tortured, you know, and they couldn't break that faith. They had this experience of reality that somehow or other they had. I mean, the purpose and meaning of life. But what happened is I remember the person picked up the papaya. And it's not the plastic stuff you get in the store here. It's the real stuff with the taste. And he looked at my friend, he said, "A fruit?" My friend said, "Yes, a fruit." Because I went in the Iron Curtain once in East Germany, and boy, you know,
see things like that. You get potatoes and beets and carrots. Anyway, so one of the persons gets out, and I take him for a walk around the Holy Land of Vrindavan. And he, I can go into a whole routine. This is the heaviest one. This is the heaviest. They couldn't break this guy. They tortured this guy. They just couldn't break him. It was amazing. So we were walking around Vrindavan. And every 10 yards, we'd see a peacock. We'd see a beautiful peacock with the feathers. It's so beautiful. And then real anger. He was talking about the communists, what they did to them. He said, how can they deny God? Does that happen by accident? Now, here's just another thing that's kind of interesting, too. So what's the explanation for things? Let's say you were in your house and it was the winter, and the next morning you woke up and there was a beautiful snowman. Now, what would your conclusion be? Now, I would say that someone made the snowman. Now, can I prove it? No, I didn't see who made the snowman. Right? It could have been, right, that in multi universes, infinite universes, that this was the one that by chance a snowman. That's the explanation that people who don't believe in a conscious reality with purpose, meaning, as a substance, that's what their conclusion is. Their conclusion is that the order and design that we see in the world here is just somehow, it's called multiverse. It just this happens to be the one. Someone gave an example. I was reading this one person. His name is Alvin Plantinga. He's brilliant. And he gave the example that someone's playing cards, right? And he's playing cards with someone. A lot of money is on the table. And the guy deals himself 21 straight hands of four aces. And the guy pulls out the gun, right? And says, this just happens to be the universe where it happened by chance. But then, you know, that's the lens you have to pick. So or let's say, you know, someone says, okay, we want to shoot this person, right? You know, the dictator. He says, okay, he gets 21 of his best marksmen. The person is laying against the wall. They're 6 feet away and they all miss. That could happen. So that's the alternative view. I mean, if you want to accept that things are happening just by chance, by molecules just moving around this way, that's the only answer you have for things having absolute design. And these are just some. I've been studying this, and it's kind of interesting. Or they're fine-tuning. I have to sit down again because I have some notes on this here. But fine-tuning. The world is so incredibly fine-tuned. This is called the anthropic argument. The world is so incredibly fine-tuned that to make life, for life to exist, they say this. I hope this is not too boring, but I'm going to get into the Rasa stuff today too. Don't worry. I'll get into everything. I got to move. But from a scientist's view, there are 15 constants, different factors that have precise values. And if any one of these constants was off by even one part in a million, or in some cases, one part in a million million, the universe could not have come to the point where we sustain life. So is the basis of everything just molecules moving around haphazardly? Or is there some conscious
being with intention, will, purpose, meaning, etc. See, so these are the kind of, it wouldn't happen. So these are various, not only that, everything gets even more. Then there's a regularity to it. There's scientific laws that things happen, if it's by chance, why do they keep on happening? Every time you throw this down, why does it fall down? If it's by chance, it could easily go up. So the regularity of nature. The modern science only has faith. They don't have any reason why this would happen. They'll tell you that. There's no reason why things would continue to go the way they go. They just have some kind of faith that this is the universe, which is the snowman coming together, not only coming together, but moving and then standing on his head and doing yoga asanas and doing the next one the next day, and it all happens and it continues to go on. Do you understand? So these two choices are there. Either accident or regularity. And here's another. This is by... this is interesting. Beauty. The beauty. It's a... Leonard Bernstein. When he was listening to Beethoven, he said, it turned out pieces of breathtaking rightness. There is something that checks throughout, that follows its own law consistently. Something we can trust that will never let us down. There's something about beauty, talking about Jen and art, beauty, aesthetics, that points that there's something fundamental in the whole basis of the universe that has rightness and order. It's great art does not hit you over the head with a simple message. It fills you with hope and gives you the strength to carry on, though you cannot define what it is that moves you. There's something beautiful. Anyway, these are just some of the... And then I was really getting into it, but it was like, oh my God, I forgot it's cosmological, I forgot all the arguments, column argument, just one cosmological argument that I thought is really strong, right? This is basically called the first cause. Like, let's say you have a watch, right? Now, the power of each spring that moves another spring is contingent. It's not instrumental. It's not within itself. So let's say you have a watch, right? And one spring moves another. It can't go on infinitely. There has to be something that's instrumental and powerful within itself. It just can't go on infinitely. There has to be some source of power that's not dependent on anything else. This is called the first cause argument. It's not dependent on anything else. Because if it's dependent on something else, Then it'll go back. It has to stop somewhere. It points to it. These are just things that, you know, Thomas Aquinas and all these people would think about. So these are just some of the... and what to speak of the moral argument. You see, the existentialists who have this view that everything is meaningless and is moving by molecules, etc., they have integrity. Because they embrace the consequences of what their belief is. Because they believe everything is molecules and it's just moving around, and therefore, nothing has meaning. And they'll say also that there's no... there's no morality. And then it was an interesting thing when I was doing this. One person said, if God is dead, then man is dead too. This is the horror of modern man. Because he ends in nothing, he is nothing. And then he quotes Dostoevsky. If there's no... When we say, sometimes you have a prejudice about the term God because you're at the Catholic school or group, whatever. And we have a prejudice. But let's just say it's this concept, this fundamental thing. If there's no God, then objective right and wrong cannot exist. Because molecules moving around accidentally don't give you meaning or value. So Dostoevsky said, all things are permitted. If there's no basis like that. And then I have to read the book now, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Anybody have read that? Yeah. Brad. If you read it, that's fine.
I read it in one day. It's incredible.
I have to read that book because evidently the story is that someone, a young teenager or something, becomes an atheist. And he starts to analyze and think, well, actually, if the basis of everything has no reason or cause, and it's just haphazard, there's no morality. So he said, now, let me be consistent with my views. And he kills this old lady. And then he feels guilty. He feels guilty. And there is such I just want to get to that section. So many notes. Camus has been rightly criticized for inconsistently holding both to the absurdity of life and the ethics of human love and brotherhood. The two are incompatible. You can't have both. People who laugh at the claim that there is a transcendent moral order do not think that racial genocide is just impractical or self-defeating, but that it is wrong. But they have no basis for thinking it's wrong. That they feel it's wrong is good, because it is wrong. But it's not wrong because of evolutionary biology, that molecules move. There may be evolution or not, but if you believe that they moved around and then somehow or other it was better to be altruistic because your tribe survived, but yet the caveman that grabbed the woman by the hair and banged her over the head is the one that got her pregnant and propagated the race. Not the one that was like, it's better for our... So... It is inconsistent to say life is objectively absurd and then to say that one may create meaning for his life. So it doesn't come from molecules. So basically I just kind of summed it up kind of quickly, but these are the choices. And now when you come and you have reason, you have purpose, you have meaning, that means that there's a substance which everything comes from, the source of everything, that has inherent within itself some rightness, meaning that makes everything else. Yes.
So if you do believe that there is like this fundamental concept and that there is moral order and all these things, how do you, and you believe there's a purpose, does anyone actually know what the purpose is? Like, is there any, like, can you, if you reach that, do you know that purpose? Or is this just a constant search for a purpose?
Yeah, okay. Well, first of you saying, well, there is a purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if there's a purpose, and the purpose has created everything, the purpose can also make itself known.
Right.
And people in spiritual traditions, and even when I say, could God be blue? And actually, it's not a sectarian concept. Even the concept in India, in Sanskrit, of religion is dharma. it doesn't give, like, it's not a particular faith. It's the nature of faith, they say, is the nature of the soul to be connected with something higher. It's not a particular, but the point is if you do believe there's a purpose, a meaning, a sense, can it be known? If that purpose, meaning wants it to be known. And people in spiritual traditions feel in different lines of teachers, there's something that's coming down from that purpose that makes itself known and gives you the ways and means to understand it. Any other questions? Okay, so far we're following. Now, this is interesting that I can even give a class like this and get it all in. I mean, look, I got to see what my notes look like. Unbelievable, it's like. So, okay, now, reasonability of a personal conception of God. Is God a person? Right? And so interesting. And the best answer that I got is, again, I can't pronounce it. I think his name is Alvin Plantinga. He's about 85 now. He's a very, very brilliant, I guess, Christian philosopher. It's very interesting. So he was asked, is God a person? And I love his answer. He said, God is not less than a person. If there's an absolute reality, which everything is coming from, it can't be less. So would you deny love in God? Would you deny communication? I remember when I first came to the Krishna consciousness movement, I had to add some stories with the philosophy to just keep things interesting. My wonderful, loving Jewish mother was not happy. I was not as fortunate as Alex, who has this incredibly supportive, loving mother that just wants her son to realize God. Really. Very fortunate, Alex.
I know. Good answer.
Good progeny, good source. That's another thing, that the psychology, the stability of someone is the relationship generally with the mother. And they get that good affection and love. It gives them a certain security. So I remember with my mother, she wasn't. I came home one day from the Sunday feast at the Hare Krishna Temple in Henry Street, in Brooklyn Heights, with a plate of the sacred foods for her. I had terrible strategies. And we got into a little argument. And, you know, and she was saying, and I said, you don't even believe in God. I got really angry, you know. She said, I believe in God, but God is just a feeling. And I said, well, then you're more than God. Because you have more than feelings. You have family, you have so many things. And then the real argument is, if it's a person, and not limited. We don't have to limit it. We don't have to say, even when we say Krishna is blue, is it really, are we projecting on it and actually understanding deeply what that means? But, you know, at least, if we see and we accept that there's rightness and there's morality and there's reason, it has to come from something conscious with the qualities of personhood. There's no and you know, one time Paramananda's guru, Ravindra Sarup Prabhu, he came to my guru Prabhupada and he said, I'm going to write, you know, something that, you know, how God is just a person, right? And then, do you remember that thing that he said? And he said, why just write that God is just a person? He's also Vermont. You know, when it points to it. We can see it. That's ultimate substance. It has to have some communication, reciprocation, intention, will. The things that we call personhood. And form. This is what I wrote. I said, form is limiting, but to not have form is limiting. Therefore, God must have an unlimited form. Does that make sense, Graham? Mm-hmm. Deborah, that makes sense? What?
Not really. I mean, what is an unlimited form?
What?
What you said?
Ooh, that's unlimited form.
You said that things form is limiting.
In other words,
no form is limited. Yeah. You have to have unlimited form.
In other words, you can't deny it has form, right? I'll give you a Krishna story that kind of explains it. That's what Bryn came to the class for. That's what she wanted to do. I know it, but I will get into that too. Yeah, to explain your question, it'd be something like this. This is unlimited form. Krishna was eating dirt. So his mother became very upset with him. So she looked in his mouth to clean out his mouth. And when she looked in the mouth, she saw herself. And she saw everything else. She saw within Krishna everything, including that's with outside Krishna. So if you say God does not have a form, then you're limiting God. But if you say it's a limited form, you're also limiting God. Okay. So that's basically, and I don't have, now the reasonability of the Krishna conception. I'll tell you a story about this. Is I was in college, and you know what I was studying? Aeronautics. I was taking up space. Okay. Rin, do I have some potential here? Do I have some Paramananda? There's another career for me in case this doesn't work out. So I was studying philosophy actually. And they had a definition of God. God is that being of which no greater can exist. And then one day, I got the book of Krishna. And I saw that the descriptions of Krishna were of God. God, the basic definition of God given in the sacred texts of India is Advayam Gyan, which is consciousness, which nothing is separate from. Consciousness, which nothing is separate from. That's Advayam Gyan. Right? So I thought, yes, it was Advayam Gyan. Non-dual consciousness. But it also had loving relationships. It also had family. It also had pastimes. I said, yes, this must be God. That being of what you know greater can. I can conceive of something greater than consciousness, which is pervading everything. That's consciousness, which is pervading everything, which also is beautiful and charming and loving and can relate. It's not limited. So I thought, yes, this must be it. This must be God. But in the same sense, it's not sectarian. There's one thing that can manifest in many, many ways. This example is sometimes, if you see a mountain in the distance, you see homogeneous mass. You see, there's the mountain. If you come closer, you'll see trees. You ever been in the Himalayas? Anybody been in the Himalayas? You go, then you go to the roads there. Where were you in the Himalayas?
It's up the side of the Rishikesh, and then I traveled up.
Rishikesh, beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
My God, when I went to the Himalayas, and I drove, and I'll only do it once, because with the crazy bus drivers, you know, they don't have wheels like this. It's kind of this way. And you kind of like look out the window, you don't see the road. And there's no railings. So I went once. So, you know, I was up. I was so far up this place, Runnycate. And then somehow, we ran out of supplies. Let's go back to Vrindavan. I was in charge of the bus of people. And we're going back to Vrindavan. I said, stop the bus. And then just looking out in those mountains. Deborah, Mark, have you go to the Himalayas? Looking at those mountain ranges. Those incredible mountain ranges. I thought the Himalayas, when I thought the Himalayas, like something up high, but So awe-inspiring. But so the concept of so there's one thing that is that underlying principle of reality, and it can be viewed in different ways according to your approach and your perspective. It's just like a person. If someone is the high court judge, he's sitting on the bench. The high court judge is sitting on the bench. And when he sits on the bench, you know, order in the court. I don't have time to go into the very humorous story where my brother, who works on Sternhorn Street, is the senior court officer for like 45 years, about 15, 20 years ago. I wanted to bring him some gift for the holidays. And you know, I had one student said, okay, we can bake him some pies. I said, great. So here I was trying to get into the courts the way I'm dressed with pies. I didn't look suspicious. So the high court judge. Right? Then the high court judge goes home. What happens when the high court judge goes home? He could be himself. Right? And what happens? More of himself is manifest. When the high court judge goes home, more of himself is manifest. Because what is person? What is our experience of person? Our experience of person is their love, is their relationships, is their friendship, is their romance, is their maternal feelings. That's the ultimate basis of personhood. So here's an idea to help you understand the concept of truth. There's one absolute reality can manifest in many ways. The concept of Krishna is God at home. That the concept is that position covers personality. When you sit very, very high and very, very high and majestic, which is that absolute reality. When you sit very high and very majestic, very little of yourself can be revealed. Only one part of yourself can be revealed. I am the boss. Which is also, it may be the most loving boss in the world, but it's not your friend. It's not your lover. It's not your the parental stuff. So the idea of Krishna, and I coined this, and I patented it, and if you steal it without using my name, I sue you. Okay? So I coined this term. Krishna means God with his guard down. Full love comes when there is equality. So if God is a person, the full manifestation of that person is not when he's sitting on the high court bench. Order in the court. It's when he's home. So the idea of Krishna is God at home. And therefore, in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it explains that Krishna means Akila Rasamrita Murti. It is the full embodiment of love. Even in the Upanishads, when it describes the absolute reality, it says, Rasa Vai Saha. I am love. And what type of love? I am love to the highest degree. I am love that's overwhelming. And therefore I am a friend. There's only friendship among equals. So the concept of this particular perspective, from our tradition, I have my prejudices, naturally. I don't call prejudices, but I have my view. But from that, this is the full manifestation. It's the same person. It's the same Advaita Gyan. It's the same majesty. There's one absolute reality. What Krishna means is when the full self, the full being comes out. Overwhelming friendship, overwhelming pure romance, overwhelming parental feelings. So that's the reasonability of Krishna. And in the drama that I wrote, and I was going to perform it today, but I would do it in a place where I never did it before. And I've done it so many times here. But, I absolutely forgot that section. That's okay. I will just coolly recover like nothing happened. I forgot the most important thing. I'm just not going to go on. But I wrote this drama with this one actor and playwright. And in it, they discover this ancient text where it has an appendix called the reasonability for the divinity of Krishna. So the first principles, this is very reasonable. Everyone here is searching for pleasure. And pleasure is love. If that is the guiding principle here, why shouldn't that exist in the absolute reality? Therefore, that one harmonious whole must have some distinctions for the purpose of the exchange of love. And in Sanskrit, this is called Shakti and Shaktiman. They're common terms. God is the possessor of potency, and there's potency. There's energy. And the purpose of energy is to serve its source. Therefore, the essence of all energy is love. So Krishna, Radha Krishna, Radha Govinda, and this is the most beautiful poster of Radha Govinda deities. The concept is that what we're seeing here as the fundamental reality exists in perfection as the totality of reality, which is an exchange of love between Shakti, potency, and the source of potency. So it's a reasonable conception. I'm going to prove it. I'll prove it. Come.
teaching? No. Is it a reasonable conception? Yes, it's a reasonable conception. Keeping on time, which is my nature, is now just to discuss, you know, there's all these stories about Krishna. Beautiful stories. And the last thing I want to explain is that a reasonable conception of the ultimate reality is activities of love. There's a subtle point here I want to make, but I'm just going to... I'm just going to tell you just a short little history of something that was very interesting that happened. Is I got this incredible book called Acting as a Way of Salvation. It's a very interesting book, and it discusses the pastimes of Krishna. But it discusses in India what's called aesthetic theory. And there's even one sacred text in India called the Natya Shastra. The Natya Shastra is the sacred text about drama. And it's a very interesting story that Lord Brahma is the kind of chief engineer of the universe, and Indra's kind of the manager, and somehow Indra feels people are not transcending ego. Because spiritual life means one thing. You have to get out of the center or develop the mood of serving the center rather than being the center. Material consciousness is this ego, which is actually so dissatisfying because it's not the platform where love flows. And we know that's a central reality. So he goes to Lord Brahma, and Lord Brahma kind of meditates, and he said, we need something audible and visible to help people get free from ego. And then there's a sacred text that describes drama. So what is drama? What drama is you look at human experience and you study what's called rasa. Rasa is overwhelming emotions, like tragedy. When you have tragedy, you can't think of anything else but your sadness. Romance, you can't think of anything else but your lover. Chivalry, you can't think of anything else but conquer the enemy. Fear. I remember when I grew up, we used to love all those dramas. But the scariest one I saw, I don't know why. I mean, you ever heard of the movie The Blob? Generally, I say things, and because I'm older than people, they don't know. I said Nikita Khrushchev in the last class, no one knew who he was. Except Bram. He was the only one who was there. I said Jack Benny, no one knew who he was. So, you heard of The Blob? So, the fear. So, there's different overwhelming emotions. So, what this Bharat Muni did was very, very interesting. What Bharat Muni did is he studied, it was channeled from Lord Brahma to this Bharat Muni, this great sage channeled it, and he studied human experience and said, who are the players in that experience of, let's say, tragedy? There's eight rasas, eight overwhelming experiences. Who are the players in that? What is the setting of it? What are the actions of it? What is the core feeling of it? What are the accessory motions of it? So when you know those things, and it's very technical. This book that I have, Malati, where's the book? You have it with you, Waves of Devotion?
Yeah.
I wrote a commentary on this very technical book on, it's just so many charts, and it's very amazing, and it's how emotion gets to the height of just being consumed. And so what a drama is if you can recreate that emotion in drama, then what will happen is, if the audience is qualified, they will experience the same thing. But then there was all kinds of aestheticians that came with spiritual theories how that was kind of elevating. One way is you have the experience, but your experience is devoid of ego, because it's not your experience, but you kind of get the experience devoid of ego. Other things, you actually have the feeling of this, what's called rasa, then there has to be, the audience has to be one mind. Just like when I'm lecturing and you're a teacher, Bram, and you know this, Bram, you're teaching in yoga, you know, the class is really on, well, you have the sense that everyone is hearing, everyone is understanding exactly what you say in the same exact way. Right? And when there's one person there that maybe, you know, comes new or from a different something or other, and you're feeling that they don't understand it the same way, it affects the whole audience. So what rasa means is, so there had to be like a feeling of one mind. So a lot of the Advaita Vedantins and impersonalists would say that this was the preliminary feeling of oneness. I should mention, in terms of oneness, in the Krishna conception, everything is one, but just like this. This is my body. The tape there, I'm pointing to my hand. This is my nose. This is my body, I'm pointing to my nose. This is my knee. It's all my body. It's all one. It's all the body. But at the same time, my hand is not my foot. My belly is not my nose. But anyway, there were many, many people who had these theories. It's a fascinating subject. Then what happened is, in our tradition, that was 2,000 years ago, not Yashastra. And what happened in our tradition is one of our teachers, and for a drama to actually have that effect, it had to be perfectly composed. If the elements, they're called bhavas, there are five bhavas, if one of them was not suitable, you wouldn't have that exaltation, you wouldn't have that feeling. And someone who's cultured would not read a drama like that, would not appreciate a drama like that. It was so technical. But it would create this force of feeling. So what happened is, one of the teachers in our tradition, he was a kavi. Kavi is a master poet that you can't even imagine what they can do. One day, I think I'll do something on poetry here. It'll blow people's minds if you can see what a kavi can do with poetry. They can write a poem in Sanskrit where it says the same thing exactly frontwards and backwards, like this. And diagonally. It's just that there's about 12 exercises they do. It's just amazing. And a book is coming out called Chitta Rupini. It's going to show you that. But so what happens is, he looked at the stories of Krishna, which supposedly predated the Natya Shastra by hundreds or thousands of years. And he saw that the pastimes of Krishna, the stories of Krishna, were perfectly composed according to this ascetic theory, even though it predated it. Perfectly composed. And if you actually got a sound, I'm going to give you a little sense of it, but not much today. There's not that much time. So what happened is, therefore, what he concluded is, but what was the feeling? Was it tragedy that was being presented in Krishna's stories? Was it romance? What was the rasa? It's called rasa, the consuming, overwhelming emotion.
It was love of God. So what he understood is that the ultimate reality is a total aesthetic experience of overwhelming love for God. That was his conclusion. And that the Krishna pastimes, even though they may appear to be stories, if you just go a little deeper, you'll see the deepest aesthetics. I just want to just backtrack one point too. Actually, I have to give a little thanks to Professor Matthew Dasty, one of my students, who's a professor of philosophy in Boston. And I went over some of these concepts with him. But we discussing reasonability of Krishna Lila. Look, if there's an ultimate reality of Lila, right, if we do believe that the basis of reality is being, and you cannot separate being. Being is not the right word, because it can be matter, but consciousness or personhood. If you cannot separate from love, then you cannot separate it from expression of love. Love finds its fruition not in abstraction. It finds its fruition in expression. And the name that we give in Sanskrit to that concrete expression of love is called lila, or pastimes. So these pastimes, you may externally, you can project on them in one sense that this may seem to be mythological or whatever. You can project on it that way, that's okay. What I'm saying, you can also look at it that yes, this makes sense. That the ultimate reality is an aesthetic experience. In fact, in our tradition, the essence of God's bliss potency is love. And the highest love is Tvasmin Parama Prema Rup. The highest love, Parama Prema. Tvasmin parama prema rup, parama prema rup, the form, part of the highest love is love for everything. And that's called love of God. Love of that substance, that being in reality, which does not have the defect of impersonality. It can reciprocate, and it's beautiful. And therefore, the first thing in love, in rasa theory, is there has to be a proper object of love. For example, if there is parental love, the object of love has to be a child. Because the mood of love is anugraha or mercy. Mercy requires an object of love. Object of mercy. So if God wants to enjoy parental love, then God has to appear as a child. If God wants to enjoy friendship, he has to appear as the same age, as equals. If he wants to appear romance, he has to be Navayogam, between 12 and 16 is the best age. And beauty. So, if you read the Krishna pastimes, you'll see the manifestation of the divine in the supreme manifestation of and beauty. And that's what we feel. If I look at myself and what do I want to achieve in my spiritual practices, ultimately I want love. I want overwhelming love. And love means relationship. I want a particular relationship. Love comes in relationships, a friendship. And I want it to be pure. And I want the object of love to be perfect. So that's the Krishna conception. Now, I'll just show you how it works a little bit. And I am asking the audience, I know sometimes when people come, when you say the class is from 7:30 to 9, people who work so hard, they have trains to catch, things to do. I'm going to go 15 more minutes.
if anyone has to go without judgment, I understand that you have to go. Like Julie, who wants to be here more than anyone else, because she's experiencing overwhelming love of Godhead.
But unfortunately, I live in another state.
What's that?
Unfortunately, I live in another state.
Okay, thank you for coming, Julie.
We'll see you soon.
Okay, so catch your bus or train. But that's it. Anybody else? I'm going to go 15 more minutes. Okay? And are you taping a two-part one?
No.
Is it working?
Yeah.
You're getting everything? Okay. Okay, because there's so many people that asked if they couldn't come here today. And someone wanted to stream it. And I said, no, you've got to come. Okay. So I'll just tell you one Krishna story. Brin, should I read that story or should I just tell it? What do you think?
Which, the one that I
tell it.
Tell it.
Tell it?
Yeah.
Okay. So, now first, love must have a perfect object. So Krishna is the most beautiful. Baharpidam natavarabhu karniyo karni karyam vibhradvisham kanika kapi sambhaijyanti. He's baharpidam natavarabhu. He has a peacock feather. Karniyo karnikam. Beautiful tulips in his ears. Bibrad Vishad. He has this golden garment. Shaimam, Shantam, Trivangam. He has threefold bending form and lotus eyes, and is just the most beautiful object of beauty. And he goes out to the forest every day as a cowherd boy, just a young cowherd boy. And he goes out to the forest every day with his friends, and he's playing the flute, expressing the deepest, most love in his heart. And Brin especially likes this description, how beautiful Krishna is and how much love there is for, in the different relationships with Krishna. So what happens is Krishna is so beautiful that, you know, when you're taking care of the cows, friends go in different parts of the forest. And when they see Krishna, there's so much love. It's called prema bhakti. Sandrandana visheshatma. It's love that is so thick and so consuming and so overwhelming. Sandra, it's like there's nothing else in the consciousness. Not even a pin can get through. It's so thick. That love is so beautiful. He's so beautiful. He's going through the forest. And when he's going with his cows, sometimes in the distance a cowherd boy would see that he goes behind the tree. Okay? So Brin will be the cowherd boy. And she's in love with Krishna. To say, Krishna!
Wait, you didn't go behind yet. Krishna! Oh, okay. Krishna! Oh. Krishna!
So much, there's so much separation. Every time he disappears behind a tree. So then there's a whole story, and then he somehow swallows a forest fire, and his friends are thirsty, and his friends are thirsty, and they go to the river, and they drink, and they drink, and it's poisoned. And then they practically die. And then Krishna comes, and with his merciful glance, he wakes them up to life, and they're about to die, and just as about to die, taking almost their last breath, they feel an overwhelming mercy consuming their bodies, bringing them back to life. And then they see Krishna.
So what happens is they have their friendship. What happens to their friendship? Their friendship just wells to the highest degree. They become consumed with their friendship. And then Krishna looks out and he sees that the whole area has been poisoned by this deadly serpent within the river. And he sees even a bird flying overhead and the fumes. And one of the cowherd boys sees the bird and he says, "Stop!" It's too late. The bird drops and dies. And then Krishna is thinking, because he loves his setting, the environment, Vrindavan, the land, the rural, the birds, the bees, the trees, the flowers, creating the setting, the atmosphere for the most open-hearted love to be exchanged. And he's seeing that they're destroying my Vrindavan. So Krishna climbs onto one tree and he ties his belt and he jumps. The water is just boiling with poison. And he jumps into the water. I have to make a long story short. But the snake, the multi-headed snake, gets Krishna in his coils. And he's got Krishna in his coils. And what's happening to the feelings of his friends? What's happening to their love? And the calves who love Krishna also, the cows love Krishna as a mother, and the calves as their protector. So what's happening? All this love and pleasure actually is flowing from their hearts. They're being consumed by this overwhelming expression of love. And then the gopis, the girlfriends of Krishna, they look out and they see Krishna. And then they remember his smiles. They remember his dealings. And tapta sukham shunyam. What is it? Dukkha tapta. Krishna is their life. Without Krishna, their life becomes zero. Spiritual depression. And their love. So what is happening is the feelings by the Leela, by this Shakti, this potency that's organizing the story, the love, the existential love, the ontological love, I should say, the potency of God's love that's put in the heart of one who wants to serve him more than anything else, that energy is flowing towards Krishna. And they're becoming overwhelmed. Krishna's enjoying the love. The love is flowing through the hearts. And then back in the village, Krishna's parents are there, and all their friends are there, the rest of the people, because Krishna goes out. When Krishna goes out to the forest every day, his parents, they go out five times. Don't forget your please, the older brother Balaram, please protect Krishna. What has happened to their love? And the gopis, in their houses, there's so much separation. Actually, only the cowherd boys were there. The gopis were not there yet. The girlfriends are not there yet. So what happens is, when Krishna goes out into the forest every day, they love him so much that one lady with her little child, she wants to see Krishna. He's so beautiful. And there's so much love. And she, with a little child, she wants to go out to see Krishna. But she also has to do her household tasks. She has to get water from the well. So she's seeing Krishna. And there's so much love in her heart just to see. And the separation from Krishna. It's described, the love is so intense. When Krishna goes to the forest, the whole forest blooms in jubilation. And when Krishna goes back in the evening, all the leaves and flowers wither. It's described that that prema bhakti, that river of love, it has two embankments.
and it flows so powerful. And one embankment is the embankment of union, and one is the embankment of separation. So both, so when Krishna leaves, all the residents in Vrindavan, they're feeling such separation. A moment seems like 12 more years or more in your absence. They're in such incredible separation. And then when Krishna comes back, they're in jubilation. And then, so this lady, she's getting separation. Krishna is leaving. Krishna is leaving the forest. He's going. And she's going to tie the rope around the bucket, but she ties it around her child. And she's about, it's like, stop! Stop! Oh my God. Krishna goes to the forest. So then in the village, what happens is, all of a sudden, there are inauspicious omens. Meteors start to fall from the sky. The ground begins to shake. And the left eye and side of the men is shaking inauspicious, and the right side of the women. My eyes are attuned to my karma. I can tell you that. I know when, I hope to, I'm trying to be beyond good and bad. Everything that comes by God's grace is to help me come closer to Him. But sometimes things I like are taken away. I know it. So what happens is they see all this auspicious, and immediately they think, Krishna, Krishna. Just like I knew this one Indian man, and he loved his daughter so much. And she was in Manhattan when the World Trade Towers came down. Thinking, my daughter, my mom, my mom. So what happened is, all the residents of Vrindavan immediately left to go find Krishna. And how can they find Krishna? Because his beautiful footprints are left in the soft sands of Vrindavan. Because no one, they love Krishna so much, they won't erase the footprints. So that the cowherd, the friends, so the parents and the gopis, they're looking at the footprints, which is inspired, Krishna's footprints. They're in love with Krishna. When you're in love with someone, and our loves are often not the purest love, they're infatuation, they're chemical, they're temporary. As Eric Fromm said, people in the modern world, they think that love, first you have a love, and then you make a commitment. But he said what real love is when you make the commitment, then the love comes. Otherwise, you just get the chemical stuff, and it's last, and then it goes. So what happens is, they love so much. So the parents are seeing the footprints, and what are they doing? They're love, my son. And the gopis are seeing the footprint. What this says is that there's an existential reality of what we see a shadow of, that there actually is something as pure, intense, overwhelming, eternal love that you can always be situated in. That's what they believe in the bhakti tradition. And the gopis are saying, my lover, my son. And what is Krishna doing? He's enjoying that energy of love. And what are the devotees? They're also enjoying that love. But it's a very strange thing. When I was young, the Good Humor truck used to come around, and kids were cruel. So we'd always ask the Good Humor man to give us some dry ice, you know, from the truck, right? And what's the quality of dry ice? It burns. It's cold, but it burns. So they say in the same way that this anxiety in Krishna Leela, it's anxiety for the highest happiness, because it's love. So to make a long story short, because this is a story that if you come to Vrindavan, I'll speak on every day for 30 days. Really. Each verse has so much unlimited meaning. So then what happened is, they come to the shore, and Krishna's mother, just feel the perfect object of eternal love, of beauty, and her perfect son, and her perfect love. It's not a temporary thing. It's the ontogenous, the love of being. And she goes and she sees her son in the water. The water is boiling with this poison, with this multi-headed snake. And she goes into the water, and she's about to run into the water. And the other elderly gopis, the other elderly mothers, stop her. And she faints. That's called Satvika Bhava. There's five bhavas that combine together and mix to make the love the highest. There is Sky Bhava, the mood of love. There's different moods of love. There's Sky Bhava. There's... Please give me 5 more minutes. Okay. There's Sky Bhava. Then there's Vibhav, the person, the relationship. Then there's Anubhav, the actions in love. Then Vyabhachari, accessory emotions, fear, disparagement, lamentation, jubilation. So it's all, this emotion is just churning. It says like when you make sweet rice, there's 5 ingredients. If for a connoisseur to appreciate, the rice cannot be too cooked or too undercooked. The milk cannot be too thick or too thin. It has to be cooked just right. The sugar has to be not too sweet and not too less sweet. And all the spices, and then a connoisseur will appreciate it. It's just described that God is a connoisseur of love. So all these ingredients are perfectly mixed. And to make a long story short, and they also get, when the gopis see Krishna, he stays in there for 48 minutes, and their life, they're just dying, and so many emotions are coming and churning this rasa, this love, and then Krishna breaks from the coils of a serpent. He starts to dance on his hood, and then they're seeing the most beautiful dancer in the world. And the red jewels on the serpent's head are like this moving stage with red light, kind of, and Krishna is starting to, he's Natavara. Baharpidam Natavara, but he has the form of the most beautiful dancer, and he's dancing so beautifully. And they're watching, and the snake is trying to, and Krishna is so dexterous. And they're loved, they're jubilated. Now they're seeing, and then Krishna's dancing, and to make a long story short, she just so many times, he dances on the hoods until they're all crushed. And the last hood of the serpent is called the false ego. Like when in sixth grade, you get in a fight, if you get beat up, you'd say, I could have had him, I had my school clothes on.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, he just never won that. Hoods are, they're all crushed. The last hood. And then somehow he defeats the serpent, and then he comes out of the water, and all the residents, what were they feeling with their love and the emotions and the beauty of Krishna? And then he comes out and his garment is wet. And the most beautiful form is not the naked form, but the form with the wet garment. So Krishna comes out with his beautiful form. And anyway, so the point is that these are all the components of rasa or bhava. And that in the concrete expression of love is this exchange, which becomes overwhelming emotion. So just to finish up, because I would just say one thing to end it. And did I just...
There's nothing.
Where is it? Okay. Thank you. I'll just say one thing to end it, and non-existence of God is not an intellectual problem, just. It's more than that. if there's not a substance and basis to reality that has reason, that has purpose and meaning, then not only are our moral choices meaningless, but all life becomes meaningless. And not only that, and what I would implore is not just believing, but actually meditating on this fact that there is meaning, there is purpose, there is a reality. And somehow the purpose of life is to kind of link with that and understand it. And then you change. Because when you understand there's a reality, you know, I didn't go in, because I said there's also arguments against the existence of God. For example, the existence of evil. I discussed that also, but how much can I say in such a short class? I'll just say one thing. Actually, suffering provides a better argument for God's existence than one I've been against it. And this is by C.S. Lewis, which is a brilliant Christian. He says, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? What was I comparing this universe when I said it's unjust? So, And many people have to admit that most of what they really needed for success in life came through their most difficult and painful experiences. With time and perspective, most of us can see good reasons for at least some of the tragedy and pain that God incurs. Why could it be possible, from the vantage point of an absolute reality, there's some good reasons for it? But that's another. So I just want to finish up with just some concept or idea that I really gleaned and thought was important. What this means for us is that instead of trying to shape our desires, that instead of seeking and control and shaping reality to fit our desires, we should shape our desires to fit reality. Did I say that again? Instead of trying to shape our desires to fit reality, we now should... Instead of trying to seek control and shape reality to fit our desires, we should try to shape our desires to fit reality. And what this meant, and the ancients looked at a person who was in anxiety. What did they try to do? Change their character, spiritual character change. Rather than trying to change the world, we have to try to change ourselves. And I can tell you very frankly, from working on this week, you know, I'm really just trying to. To get something, you have to do a lot more. You know this, Bram. To get like a 45-minute class and really understand the subject, you have to read everything on whatever, you know, Egyptian history. And then you may be able to do a class. I got so much from this. Because it just put really within my consciousness that there's really reason and purpose and consciousness and personhood and being at the root of everything. And that life is really about connecting with that. And not only connecting with that, but actually loving that. And actually achieving a position of some kind of communion relationship with the love. Are there any questions? Greg.
Okay.
I guess we're going to go a little longer if anybody has to leave. Well, 5 more minutes, I promise, it ends. Okay?
So first, thank you, Maharaj, for agreeing. Wonderful talk. And I want to kind of apologize in advance because what I'm going to say is a bit more of a comment than a question.
Go ahead.
I always,
please do.
But when you began the talk and trying to sort of go through these different reasons for why God exists, I found myself thinking there's something very egotistical about feeling this need to prove God's existence. That somehow, like, when it's proven to me, okay, well, then that's good.
Yeah.
And because I can remember that feeling when, you know, and many times in my life, like, oh, this has to be proven to me. Like, somehow, like, my validation matters.
Right.
And I think that for a lot of us, we get very hung up on that, like, in trying to understand God, ultimate reality. Like, somehow it has to be proven, and that, like, our mind somehow is, like, the final litmus test.
Yeah.
And
not proven,
but you know, but it's yeah. that sort of sense. And I've, in my own life, tried to sort of let go of that sort of notion. It just has to be proven to me. But yes. It was then when you were telling the story about Krishna dancing on the head of Kaliya, yeah. that sort of also made me realize that it's not the logical explanation
yeah.
that is going to sort of be the thing that convinces us.
Yeah.
It's the emotional stirring and the emotional reaction that we have to the stories that, in a way, provide us with the confirmation that it resonates so powerfully in our heart.
Yeah.
And even though it may not make logical sense, but
yeah.
that truly is the proof in many ways.
Yeah.
And it's hearing the stories and having the opportunity to have you tell the stories that's so great. So thank you.
So I should have just told the stories. But no, I appreciate that comment, and I was really trying to present that the real thing is the experience, and but there is a connection between understanding and experience, because you have to move in a direction for a certain experience, and unless there's some preliminary understanding, you won't. And in my own experience is, and say, me coming to Krishna consciousness, so to speak, or whatever it is. And again, and I really look at people that have that kind of mood of service and love for God, for everything, etc. It doesn't have to be my particular form or thing, but I have my conviction. What happens is to keep yourself open to the experience, right? And I can't make a class that's also suitable to everyone. To make myself open to the experience, right? You need to have some understanding. Because without some kind of reason or faith, you don't move in any direction. You know? But thank you for appreciating the stories. I like that best too. I appreciate your point. Any other questions? David Jinta, last one. Okay.
You were said at the end there to modify your desires to fit reality. Can you give one example, please?
To fit reality? Yeah, it becomes obvious in your life, right, that God is taking, that reality is taking something away from you. Right? It becomes obvious, right? For example, when you had your business in New York, right? And it kind of became obvious with your close relatives suing your butt off and everything else that happened with you. Right? Remember that? You know? And it became
true,
right? And somehow you were meant to move in another direction. That was reality. So rather than try to change that reality and fight it, right, change your conception. Right? I have to be detached from this. You know, I was the person, and I have to tell you, he used to have a business, and Kasturba was the cook, and Kinchana Krishna was the bookkeeper. And the thing is, there was lunch for everyone would come in, right? And he had that business, and somehow I never really had much money, but if I go to his place, right? Then, you know, before I go to India, you know, he'd shake my hand like an uncle, you know? And, you know, it'd be like, you know, $1,000 in it, you know? And he was so generous. In fact, he was so generous with the whole Bhakti Center. I have to say this right now. It all started with him supporting the monks that went to Manhattan. That's how they were able to be in Manhattan and get the Bhakti Center. He was... And Radhanath Swami was so happy with his generosity right? That I remember he came to his birthday party. Remember that? But then he couldn't do that anymore, right? You couldn't, you know, it was kind of taken away in a way, right? So that's an example, like, you know, rather than fight it, then, you know, your life changes. And you have to learn, well, maybe I'm supposed to be detached from this and things like that. So that's what it means. You change your consciousness. It's not, there's another class, but you should definitely try to conform the world to some degree to your own needs so you can be peaceful. But that's not happiness in itself. The happiness is the changing of the consciousness. Right? So sometimes when there's difficulties, rather than still trying to go out there and control them, it's maybe time to change the consciousness and understand things deeper. So that would be an example. Does that help?
Yeah.
And thank you for your wonderful, we had, you know, wonderful service that you did for all the Vaishnavas for so many years, helping to establish the Bhakti Center. So we'll end now, and I went late, but thank you all so much. If I do have we did this last time, if you'd like the tape of this, we can send it to you if you want to put your name. Grant, you didn't bring any donuts, did you?
Sorry.
That's the only, I always like to have the so, okay, thank you all. This was fun. Okay?
Thank you, Maharaj.
If anybody wants to be on my mailing list, too, whoever it is, I can send you. And if you want to be on this for any things that we said. And thank Bryn and Yoga Maya for their cutting edge of trying to have quality teachings in the yoga world. And they branded Yoga Maya in a particular way that was quite spiritual, that maybe some people wouldn't have been as comfortable with, but they kind of stuck with it, you know, a particular mood, and now it just has a congregation of people who have that mood of kind of spirituality. So that's really a wonderful thing. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks, everybody, for coming.